Good morning, we're going to call the meeting to order, please. First, I'd like to say I'm sort of adjusting to the chair. I think Jim's legs are a little longer than but I wanted to thank Jim for his service as president of the commission. Jim served on the commission since December 2009 and as president since 2012. And in his time, he's accomplished a number of goals of the commission and a number of milestones that have been put forward, I think, have really benefited from his leadership. For example, he's been a strong advocate for proactive engagement on equity in the environment and core programs, partnerships, and policies. He's helped oversee the beginning of nearly $2 billion of improvement Portland International Airport, which will result in an innovative and flexible airport for today and generations to come. And he's helped shape the future of Terminal 6 by setting a strategic vision to identify the best ways to offer regional shippers options to move their goods. We thank you for your steadfast leadership. Jim, we are grateful that you're willing to continue to serve for a while with us. And I'm sure I will benefit probably from that service. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you for the comments. You're going to make a great president, and I think the commission stands in great shape with the people who are part of it. And I will be here for a few more months, apparently, until there's another person appointed to my position. So thanks very much.
Now I'd like to call for a motion and second to grant a leave of absence to Commissioner Young, who's out of town. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? So granted. Now I call for a motion and second for approval of the minutes of the regular commission meeting of December 13th, 2017.
So moved.
Having a first and second, any comments or discussion on the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? And now I'd like to ask Curtis Robin Hope for the executive director's report and his remarks.
Thank you, Madam President. It's a real treat to welcome you as chair, and I also want to add my thanks to Jim both for his great service, the great work that you didn't mention in leading the search for and hiring of an outstanding new executive director. Really a great choice. And also your willingness, Jim, to stick around. I really appreciate it. I know the governor asked you to stick around until the seat gets filled, and that is a great help to us, of course. I'd also like to welcome, if I can, I don't know if I'm trumping you when I do it, but I want to welcome our new employees. We've got a group of new employees, about 20 this time, our current class, and it's a really diverse and interesting bunch. Got to spend some time with them last week, and so welcome. I hope you enjoy the conversation here. This is going to be a good commission meeting, I think, talking about and getting in some depth on the activities out of Terminal 6 and our efforts to help Oregon shippers. So it's really, I think, a good opportunity for all of you. I'd also like to acknowledge the port's safety champions who are rotating up here. A group from different parts of the port, really an indication of our commitment, I hope, to folks in all parts of the business. I actually got to talk with Mike about the work he did on the digital front to help us with systems to help track issues around safety. It's really important to us at the port to have folks in every role know that safety is part of their job too, and hopefully you all will get a chance to see the folks who are our safety champions this month. Stan, I wonder if you'd give us a safety moment this morning.
Sure. So over the last couple of years, we've been working diligently in a lot of areas to improve our safety program. And we're seeing a higher level of reporting of near misses and incidents. And at the same time that we're seeing that happen, we're reducing our overall claims and the severity of some of the incidents. So that's really good to see how the program's been moving forward and some of the results that we're getting. This year, we're going to be executing more specific plans to further develop our safety culture. And one of the tools that we're in the process of executing is conducting an employee safety perception survey. The survey will evaluate 20 indicators. So for example, it will evaluate our safety climate, our safety operating procedures, communications, management credibility, and and safety supervision. The survey will be port-wide, and we will be able to evaluate it on a departmental basis. Our goal is to provide a baseline safety culture assessment that will help us measure employee perceptions as a means to effectively improve our safety culture. It will help us identify how well management practices are driving safety performance. It will provide an independent and objective view of our strengths and weaknesses, and it will help determine where our gaps are. And it will place emphasis on potential safety system improvements to help drive better performance, and it will assist us in making proper adjustments to our strategic safety plans. And as we move forward, I do plan on using this monthly safety moment to keep you all informed about our safety plans and on our progress in advancing our safety systems and culture. So we're kind of excited to get this new baseline assessment so that we can really understand where are the employees at within our safety culture to help us make adjustments to our safety plan. So we're kind of excited to get this going.
Great. Thank you, Stan.
Yep.
And for those of you who are here for your first time, this is a couple minutes where I essentially get the stage to share some of the activity of what's been going on here at the port for the past month, maybe highlight a few of the activities going on. We'll hear much more about T6 later in this meeting, but I did want to talk a bit about some additional good news for Oregon shippers that we announced earlier this month. We have a new rail shuttle to the Puget Sound port coming out of T6 in partnership with the BNSF, moving containers between Portland and Seattle-Tacoma, where goods will then be loaded onto ocean carriers. This is not in itself a solution, but this is another step toward putting together a business model that can work out of T6, and we're really excited about it. We're really excited about the partnership with the BN and with shippers who are already engaged in using that service. Keith, we've done, I think, four rail trips already, and notionally it should be at about 1,000 containers a week when it's up and running. Yep. in four. So in particular on days like this, when you're working in the rain, everyone wants to be on a northbound train. PDX year-end numbers are in, and it's very good news. Again, we knew this was coming, but we passed the 19 million passenger threshold. We just continue to grow apace. It's exciting, and we're encouraged by it. What it tells us is that the regional economy is booming, and folks are continuing to travel, both for business and leisure. We're really excited about a lot of the new offerings at the airport, and we're trying to keep that focus on the customer with 19 million passengers as we did with 18 million. We just keep seeing those numbers grow, and our current forecasts are up, so expect that number to continue to grow next year. On the community side in Hillsboro, we once again would like to invite people to participate in our master planning process out at Hillsboro Airport. It's the Hillsboro Master Plan Airport Master Plan update, and it's a two-year process, and it's really important to us that we get community input in that process. So you can engage online. We also have created a number of opportunities, including some multilingual opportunities for folks to participate in person. This year, we're celebrating our 15th anniversary of partnership with Portland State University's Community Environmental Services Program, where students have helped us launch innovative efforts to reduce, reuse, and recycle waste. We've had some great press coverage on the program. It's very exciting. We've had 35 student interns who have been gaining on-hand experience inside PDX, including some work on an airport concessions waste diversion rate, which is now at 63%. A food waste program that's composted 2,300 tons of food, and pre-security liquid collection stations that are a model for airports around the country. So we really appreciate the work with PSU and the PSU students who help make us better. We recently established a partnership with the City of Portland, State of Oregon, Department of State Lands, and Multnomah County, providing funding to the Multnomah County Public Health Department to create a new fish consumption advisory program. We're really trying to help people along the river understand the risk of fishing for resident fish in what is a Superfund area. It's really important to us to help get that message out. We think the Multnomah County Health Department is really the best able to reach out in a number of languages, especially for those communities who tend to fish for those resident fish. And we're hopeful that this will help folks understand the risk of fishing in the Lower Willamette River. And then finally, just by way of update, we talked in the last commission meeting and one before that about an effort to really better understand where we are with our concessions program inside PDX. We've had some really good conversations about the progress after three really solid rounds of concessions redevelopment. We're very happy about that redevelopment. And as promised, we're going to try to work to identify some really good data for you all, if we can, on in particular wages and the effect of our program on wages inside the airport. So we don't have that data for you today. We're going to set out to see what we can do about getting both local data, so competitors in the region, but also some competitor airports. That data does not exist today. We've got some good comparable data around things like cost of living, but we don't have good data on specific wages inside airports. So we're going to try to see what we can find. We'll be back to you, I'm guessing, later this spring with some effort at what we've done in terms of data. So, Madam President, I love saying that. That's it for my comments today.
Thank you, Curtis. Now I'll call for a motion and second to accept the Executive Director's report.
Second.
Having a motion and second, is there any discussion on the report? Hearing none, I'll call for votes. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you. And now I'd like to open the meeting for public comment. We have a number of people signed up. I'll just call you in the order that you're signed up here, and if you would.
I'm not thinking specific to this issue, so we could take an hour.
After the presentation? Okay. So, Keen?
Good morning. Good morning, Madam President, members of the Commission. So this is a big day. This is a big milestone, I would say, for the terminal, and there's a lot of other things that are kind of culminating at the same time. So I'm really glad that we've got an agenda that allows for enough time to do this topic justice. It's not very straightforward. It's very complex, as you all know. And it's something that we've been working on for a long time. So before I get into further context, I just want to introduce Teresa Carr, our Director of Business Development and Properties. That's her day job. Her side job has been to manage this process. And she's done an amazing job, so much so that we both kind of got each other sick along the way. So we'll do our best here. And then Nolan Kimple, who heads up our consultant team. Nolan will provide the substance of the comments for today's presentation. And I'm just going to provide a little more context before we get into it. This is our terminal, 419 acres. A lot of folks just think it's the container terminal. It's not. We have very viable growing auto business kind of on both sides of what is the 200-acre footprint that has typically always been our container business. We have been in the business since the 1970s. There's probably no other mission-critical business that the port is involved in. Our mission is to provide access to markets for shippers. And that's exactly why we're in this business. It's always been a unique challenge for the organization. We have a unique market. It's more of an export-oriented cargo market than import. Those exporters really rely on this type of transportation access. And some of them are put in a very serious disadvantage when they don't have service available here. And that's been kind of where we have been over the last year. You know, the kind of the history of Terminal 6, the more recent history, starts when Hanjin and Hapag-Lloyd left in 2014. In 2015, we had a long-term lease for the terminal with ICTSI. Roughly a little more than a year ago, we had a hard time seeing a successful return of business under the current relationships that were in play with labor and with ICTSI. And we engaged in a good discussion, a negotiated discussion with ICTSI that resulted in terminating the lease. You'll recall that was last March. There's been a lot that has gone on since that time when we brought that agenda item to you. With that termination, the port received a payment, essentially a settlement of the future rent that we were foregoing. And that payment is really our working capital to stand up a new business. And we've been busy getting the terminal ready since that time, roughly over the spring and summer time period, getting the infrastructure in place. We have all the equipment. We got that also through the termination of the lease. So the terminal is now very much operationally ready. We had to level set the labor relationships that really were the kind of the underpinning of how we lost the business in the first place. We settled all of the lawsuits that were in play with the ILWU. We entered into a new memorandum of agreement with the ILWU that really sets the stage forward for collaborating together and building the business. We feel very good about where we're at with our labor relationships, but proof will be in the pudding as we continue to try to build and actually get operational activity going on as we do right now. We've been pursuing the short-term business opportunities that Curtis mentioned. We have a rail shuttle operation, really in its kind of infancy, if you will. This month, starting in 2018, the terminal is very much open for business. 5-day-a-week gate. The Swire vessel, the first vessel, will show up on the 19th or 20th of this month. We have several containers, some 60 to 80 containers now being staged to be loaded onto that vessel. We have some 40 or 50 Daimler trucks, and I'll show a picture of that staged being ready to be loaded on that vessel. So we're feeling like we've got some good momentum. These are what I would call the short-term business opportunities. The focus of the study has been on the long-term. And that's a much more challenging picture because the industry has changed a lot. And we have to kind of redefine what our niche is in that industry. And we've had the great benefit of working under Commissioner Pierce's leadership with a roughly 22, 24 member industry leader committee. Many of them are here today. If you could raise your hand. And we'll hear more from some of the folks on the committee, and there was a lot of letters submitted as part of this process. But I just can't thank them more for their effort. I think we put in 5 or 6 meetings, 3 hours apiece per meeting. So there was a good 18 to 25, like, deep dive hours volunteered by our industry leaders. So it was a really great process. And you'll hear more about that here in a moment. Couple pictures. This is the intermodal train. As Curtis mentioned, we've handled 4 so far. It's going to ramp up slowly, I think, to ultimately get to where we would like it. Why is this strategic? One, it provides shippers another option for moving their products instead of truck or other rail options. It's another competitive kind of option in the marketplace for shippers. But it also really connects Portland, which is always going to be more of a niche port with containers, to the much larger array of container offering up in the Puget Sound. They're on deeper water. They are going to have these mega vessels, mega ships, that we just simply won't have in the Columbia River. So linking ourselves through other modes of transportation to a larger array of container offering in the Puget Sound is critically important to the cargo market here. Swire, these are the containers being staged for the Swire vessel. You can see our crane in the background. These are the Western Star trucks. And the last thing I'll just say on the Swire service, it's a triangle service, it's roughly a monthly call here, They will leave the West Coast with exports down to Australia, where they will go to market. The vessel then gets loaded with Australian imports to Asia to market, and then loaded with exports from Asia to become imports coming into the U.S. West Coast. So it's very large string of ports that are covered here with this call. And as you know, Swire is a very strategic partner for us. They are a sister company, if you will, of Cathay Pacific. They are owned by the same parent company. And we really think there's a way to grow not only the volume on this particular service, but grow more services with Swire. It is the niche service that we think will compete very well for in the future. And with that, I'm going to stop and hand it over to Teresa.
Okay. Thanks, Keith. Apologies up front if I have to cough, and if I can't hear myself very well, so I'm going to try to speak and not be too loud. But as Keith mentioned, the T6 business study is a piece in the overall kind of framing of T6 for the future. And this study really focused around one primary question: what supports future role in shipping in container shipping at Terminal 6, and a sustainable business model for managing and developing that business in the future. And you can see the six questions that we formulated in the request for proposal that we asked, we wanted the consultant to answer to get to that overarching question. We also created eight discrete tasks for the consultant to walk through to, again, get to that overarching question. As you can see, the eighth task is the final report, which we're working on now. The seventh task, as Keith already mentioned, was the ILC, and the ILC was integrated and in all of these tasks, and they did a deep dive in every single task that you see up here. And Nolan will actually walk through the key findings of all of these tasks. But I just wanted you to see that this is kind of how we set this up for the consultant to walk through to get to that answer. The industry leader committee, a lot of those folks are here today, but I just want to say these 23 members were fantastic to work with. They were comprised of shippers, importers, exporters, service providers, ports, labor, and carriers. And we also had two ex officio members from the Oregon legislature, which our public affairs folks kept up to speed. We emailed them and communicated with them in different avenues to make sure they were up to speed and had the same information as in the folks who were actually in the room. The industry leader committee, their charge was to provide industry knowledge and guidance to the Port of Portland leadership on the Terminal 6 business study, and they exceeded that charge. They gave us great information each of the meetings, which we then integrated into the study. Nolan did additional research based on their input, and we are really looking forward to working with them in the future. This committee, there will be an iteration going forward. We'll talk about that a little bit later. They were diverse in their perspectives, and you'll hear a little bit about that when they come up and speak. They're not all on the same page, and that's fine. They all come from different walks of life. But they brought a lot to the table, and they took their charge very seriously. I also want to thank Commissioner Pierce as our commissioner liaison. Curtis attended almost all of the meetings. It was very engaged. Keith was there as well as a member of the committee. The leadership being there and was really important. It was important to staff and important to the committee. And they really provided a lot of guidance to us, the internal core team, which is the next slide. Oops, yeah, there we go. The internal core team, there's eight of us on that internal core team. And that team didn't just look at this business study. They were also responsible for the transition of the terminal. They worked with ICTSI. During that transition, they were responsible for the readiness of the terminal, a lot of the people that are in that core team. So they had a lot of different responsibilities in this last 6 to 8 months. And I can't say enough about the internal core team and how important they were to this process. We also had Jim Daly of Tangent Services help us during this process. He did a lot on the financial analysis and created a financial model, which is going to be very important for us going forward, because we can look at the opportunities and run it through that model and know exactly where we're at from a financial basis. And last but not least, the consultant team from Advisian, Morley Parsons. I'll introduce Nolan in just a second, but they had some subcontractors as well that helped on different parts of the process. And there's Michael Cosmala, I'd like to point out, from Coraggio Group, was a fantastic facilitator and did a great job with the industry leader committee. But Nolan was great. He was a project manager for Advisian. He was great to work with, and I'm just going to just talk a little bit about his background, because I learned something when he sent me his bio. I've been saying all along Nolan was the perfect person to do this because he kind of had the three legs of the stool. He's had stevedoring experience. He's been an executive at a steamship line, a president of a steamship line, and he was a CEO of a port. But what I did learn also was that he actually graduated from honors from New York State Maritime College, and he attended Harvard and studied strategic marketing management, but he was a ship's officer for 3 years and sailed as chief mate. So he's uniquely qualified, and it's been an honor and a pleasure to work with him on this. And he's the star of the show and has all the information on the study, so I'm going to turn it over to him. Thank you.
Thank you, Teresa. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm really happy to be at this point where we can, you know, kind of discuss the findings of this. Hold on, you drive this thing,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we should have told you that.
Okay, so our charge was to, as Teresa said, determine the port's future role in container shipping and develop a sustainable business model. And I think the key word in that whole charge is the word sustainable. And frankly, as we went through the process of doing all the tasks, we were having difficulty taking a pure container operation and coming up with a model that we could sit here and tell you is sustainable. So as you'll see from as we go through the tasks, we've kind of bent that definition a little bit to find out what we could do to prop up the container business to make it a sustainable business model for developing that business. The first thing we did is we kind of took a look at what's been going on in the industry, the shipping industry, and to a lesser extent, the terminal industry over the last several years. And since 2016, well, even way before that, there's been a lot of change and consolidation and mergers and acquisitions and that type of thing in the industry. But the activity in the last couple of years has been extreme. There's been a lot of consolidation. The carriers have, well, I'll be specific, in fact. As far as consolidation goes, Hanjin went out of business during that period of time. Hapag-Lloyd acquired United Arab Shipping Company. Maersk acquired Hamburg Süd. CMA acquired American President Lines. Costco merged with China Shipping. Costco is now trying to buy Orient Overseas Container Line, and they're rumored to want to buy the French CMA CGM as well. At the same time, what was six Japanese lines and then ultimately became three Japanese lines are now combining into what they call the Ocean Network Express, or one Japanese line. So if you add that up real quick, that's eight Trans-Pacific services that no longer exist after this year. The other interesting thing in this slide is if you look at the size of those ships up there, you have the little one on the right side of the slide and the CMA and the Maersk Line ship ahead of them. The CMA and the Maersk Line ship is what the carriers are building right now. For the most part, they're either building really small ships that they use as feeders and intra-Asia, intra-Europe, South America, South Asia kind of thing. But nobody's building the ships of the size of that little one, which is the size of a ship that can call Portland. So you can see the difference between, you know, what the trend in the industry is and what Portland can physically handle. In the years 2017 to 2019, there were 158 ships ordered, and 146 of those were being bought by alliance carriers, and I'll explain the alliances in a minute. And most of them are 10,000 TEUs or more. So that's the trend in the industry, and that's what we have to deal with. Along with the consolidation in the industry, there's been a lot of rationalization, and that's where the alliances come in. The carriers are buying these big ships, and they're unable to, an individual carrier is unable to fill that ship once a week to the United States. So the carriers have formed, they originally had four alliance groups and consolidated that into three alliance groups in this past year. The alliances are, there's the Ocean Alliance, which is CMA-CGM, Orient Overseas Container Line, Costco, and Evergreen. So that's one group of carriers. They control about 40% of the Trans-Pacific market. There's another group called the THE Alliance, which consists of the three Japanese, now becoming one Japanese carrier, Hapag-Lloyd and Yang Ming Lines. They control about 27% of the market. And then the last is the Ocean Alliance, which is, or the M2 Alliance, which is Maersk and MSC, and they control about 20% of the market. So between those three alliances, they control 87% of the Trans-Pacific market. Alliances, the members of each alliance control where the ships call, you know, what the schedule is, what the routing is, which ports they're going to call, et cetera. So you have to, it becomes hard to make any big changes with an alliance group because you got to get three or four or five carriers to agree on things. So in short, we have bigger and bigger ships, more and more of them, reduced competition in the market, which affects importers and exporters by giving them less choices of how their cargo is going to move, how to route it, where it's going to go. And it really results in the commoditization of the whole industry. There's no differentiation between these carriers anymore. They're going on the same ship through the same terminal. They're rationalizing their terminals on the West Coast. When one of those ships comes in, maybe there's three carriers on there that have a terminal in Los Angeles, but it's only going to call one of them. So they rationalize the terminals, they're rationalizing the ships, and reducing competition in the market. So that's the state of the industry. The next thing we did is we kind of took a look at what is the market for Portland. And we tried to focus on points that were more effectively served over Portland than any other gateway. And that included, as you see on the map, all of Oregon, all of Idaho, and some of the counties in southern Washington. You know, and we discovered, not surprisingly, that the majority of the cargo, both import and export, almost 90%, is Asian cargo. And as I said a minute ago, and 90% of that Asian market is controlled by those three alliances. So just keep that in mind. But this really demonstrates the importance of capturing an Asian service in Portland. The size of the market, the regional market, we figured was, I think it was 225,000 loads, which translated into 407,000 TEUs. And when we say loads, we're talking about vessel moves, basically. And then there's another 80,000 or so empties. We figure about 20% of the total volume is going to be empties moving to balance out the imbalance between imports and exports and to get equipment types in. So roughly 487,000 TEUs is the total market that's available to Portland. Having done the market analysis, we went on to do what we call a SWOT, a strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats analysis. We did this by first having port staff do a SWOT, which we, you know, we facilitated. And then we did the same thing with the ILC. Then we compared the results of the two, and we came up with one cohesive SWOT. And there wasn't a lot of differences between what port staff did and what the ILC did. And that kind of validates, I think, the fact that this is a pretty good picture of what really exists today. And as you can see from the slide, I won't read it to you per se, but you know, the inland network that you have here, the lack of local competition, no other container ports in Oregon, no other services here, the infrastructure and land in place, et cetera, make, you know, a good basis for exploring the container business and trying to bring that back. The weaknesses are just the problems that transpired during the waning of the ICTSI period, the differences between labor and ICTSI kind of tarnished the reputation of the port a little bit. the history of the terminal, there was only 2 years in the last, what, since 1974 that the port actually made a profit on the container business, and that was 1996 and 2000. The size of the market, it's a significant market at 487,000 TEUs, but it would be the smallest market served by a direct call on the West Coast. So it's not a big market. It's not insignificant, but it's not huge. The real issue is the cost of a trip from the Pacific North, that's only the cost, the time, from the Pacific Northwest to Portland, and then the cost of coming up the river, the dual pilotage, you know, all the things we all know about. But then coming back down the river and going back on a great circle back to Asia, you go right by the PNW again, and or the, I should say Seattle-Tacoma again, and Vancouver, and but you're 4 days on the schedule. By doing that, or 4 days plus. And typically that means in a string of ships, if you add 4 days to the rotation, you either have to eliminate another port or you have to add another vessel, which has its own complications in terms of it delays all the cargo by 1 week. So that's a big thing to overcome, and not much that can be done about that. Opportunities are somewhat the same as the strengths, in the sense that we see the inland connections as an opportunity to garner cargo. We see the fact that there isn't any other business in that terminal right now, or very little right now, as an opportunity for being able to do whatever you want to do in that terminal, operate however you want to operate. You're not going to displace anybody. As we saw from the ILC, there is continued demand for service here, and it's a very avid demand on the part of many exporters and some importers. The ability to attract niche services is seen as an opportunity, and now you've done that with Swire. Regional economic growth is strong, and of course there is support for the port politically. The biggest threats we saw were the ports to the north. In both Seattle and Tacoma, you have a huge terminal, each one. You have the West Sitcom in Tacoma, and you have Terminal T5 in Seattle, are both vacant, just not operating at all right now. West Sitcom would need to be very much redeveloped, as would T5, but West Sitcom could come online very quickly, and there's certainly impetus on the parts of the Northwest Seaport Alliance to find something to do with those terminals. In the time that you haven't had service, shippers have found other ways to move their cargo to market. So they have different supply chains now, and you're going to have to reattract those cargo volumes, get people to change their supply chain routings, and believe in the sustainability of the Portland operation. There's the ramp-up costs to get to break-even, and we'll talk about break-even later when we look at the financial analysis, will be high. Because until you hit that magic break-even number, you're fundamentally losing money on every box that you handle. And so managing that is going to be a very big challenge for the management people in the port. The uncertainties around labor, whether we can really achieve the productivities that we've got in the model, and whether labor relations will continue to improve, are certainly threats to this project. The increasing vessel sizes, in my opinion, is the biggest single threat that the port has. It just limits the number of potential customers that can call here. And we've already talked about the alliances and the consolidation of carrier services.
Sorry, I just want to make sure that the commission doesn't have questions to this point. There was a lot of great information there, and I don't know if people want to pause and ask questions about the SWOT analysis or if we want to continue from here.
I do have one question. On the alliances, you mentioned them under threats, but you didn't go into much detail. You gave a little more context. But what do you think is the risk of, you know, the alliances that we need to partner with staying together, and what should we be watching for in terms of
Well, I think
instability.
I think you, first of all, you hit a good point. The alliance is just reshuffled and reformed here, and so what exists today may not be what exists tomorrow. But if the trend follows through, you're going to get more and more larger and larger lines, and maybe you'll wind up with two alliances that control 90% of the market. But I think, and you'll see this later on in the presentation, I think some of the best opportunities for the Port of Portland will be outside of the alliances. Yes, the alliances control the majority of that, the big bulk of that Trans-Pacific market now, but there are independents in the market. There's Wanhai, Pacific International Line, Zim, Matson, Westwood, and Hyundai, and SM Lines. And some of those carriers are not amongst the alliance carriers that are ordering the largest ships, will operate smaller ships, and can make decisions independently. They don't have to go to four other carriers to get agreement to call Portland. And I know from my conversations with Keith and Teresa and others that the port is focused on attracting some of those. Does that answer your question?
Yes.
Okay. Anybody else? Okay. We looked at the different operating models that the port could engage in, and there's four: operating, semi-operating, landlord, and concession. And in an operating model, the port owns and operates independently, no contractors, no nothing. Semi-operational model, the port hires a terminal operator to perform some or all of the operational tasks. A landlord port is where you have a tenant, whether it's a terminal operator or a carrier, who is interested in a long-term lease, and you negotiate a lease. In each of these, there's many permutations: who provides the equipment, who does the maintenance to the equipment, who does the maintenance to the terminal, et cetera, et cetera. And those are all negotiating points. And the last is a concession, where you have somebody that says, I'm going to be here for the next 50 years. I want to give you, $50 million up front, and then take over the terminal and run it myself. The reality is, with the size of the market, you either have to be an operating or a semi-operating port. And in the case of Portland, who is not a PMA member and does not wish to become a PMA member, and who has, through the years of not having operated the terminal, lost a lot of its operating capabilities, probably a relationship with some kind of a fixed cost contract with a terminal operator would make the most sense. The other thing this graph depicts is the risk reward and control axes, which basically what this says is the more control that the port has, the more the risk is. The more you give away in terms of control, the less your risk is. So, but none of this is a panacea. We've seen concessions in Oakland, and a long-term lease in Portland and a long-term lease in Seattle all go up in smoke. So in theory, these things are, this is a really good deal. We have a concession or a lease agreement. But with all the changes in the industry and the financial problems in the industry that the carriers have endured, they're not afraid to walk away from these deals. And they've been able to do it. So based on the results of the financial analysis, which we'll look at in a second, we said we better look at some other options here. How do we make this work? We looked at other niche ports. We looked at San Diego, Port Hueneme, Philadelphia, to see what are they doing right, where they're, they have a nucleus of container business, and they seem to be doing it profitably. What do they have that we don't have? Well, in all of those cases, those ports are much, much closer to a huge population base. So they have that going for them. That's the main thing. The other thing is, in most of those cases, they focused on a niche, and most of it's around reefer cargo and food and that type of thing, which would seem to me to fit well into the economy and culture of Portland. they all have anchor tenants, and particularly in the case of Philadelphia, they have tremendous government subsidies. I mean, Philadelphia got almost $400 million just for dredging, plus other money for infrastructure. So that's a huge difference. I mean, your neighbors to the north all get government subsidy. As a taxpayer in King County, I support the Port of Seattle, whether I want to or not. I have to pay my taxes. So it's just something to think about. We looked at feeder service from Portland to Seattle-Tacoma, which is prohibitive because you'd have to use a U.S. flag vessel and U.S.-built, U.S. crewed. It'd be very, very expensive. We looked at feeder service to Vancouver. And the cost of handling, I mean, you have to put the box on the feeder, you got to take it off the feeder, you got to put it on the line haul ship. So you have to handle the box three times before it even leaves for Asia. And it just is not, doesn't make any sense. We looked at container bulk handling briefly. That's a system that's used in Australia and South America where bulk comes in containers. It's a specialized spreader that flips the container over inside the ship and dumps it out, and it's pretty dust-free and that type of thing. There may be opportunities for that. One of the people who is promoting that type of service actually lives here in Portland, so it's something that the port could certainly explore. Keith and Curtis have told you about the rail shuttle business, so I won't dwell on that, other than to say that is a nice complement to starting up the container business, because you can use the receiving, delivery, and delivery capabilities of the intermodal yard to defray some of the costs during the startup period of receiving and delivering terminals at containers at Terminal 6. We determined that, you know, the container business that you'll see in the financial analysis requires enough volume that to get to sustainability is going to take a while, and it's not an easy task. So if we can reduce the footprint of the container terminal by using some of that space for other activities, for break bulk cargo or steel or whatever else the port can attract, and that cargo is profitable and can subsidize the startup of the container operations, then that is the way to go, in our opinion. That's kind of what we looked at for alternatives. And then the financial analysis, I would just pause 1 minute to also echo my thoughts on the ILC. I agree with everything that Teresa and Keith said. That was a great experience and great people. But also, the port staff was great. I mean, the financial support we got in trying to put this together from Jim Daly and from the port's financial staff was incredible. And the support throughout on the project team was just great. Obviously, there's three drivers. You got your volume, your costs or productivity, and you've got your rate. The volume is a big stretch to get to where we need to be to make the port sustainable. Productivity, we have assumptions in the model that go back to what the productivity was in the 2006 to 2009 time frame. It's reflective of what normal productivity is on other container ports on the West Coast, and we bake those into the model. So we have to hit those numbers, not only in crane moves per hour, but in the gate moves, in the yard operation, in the gear locker. It's all inclusive. Pricing, we started with what we were getting back in 2009, I think, and then we ramped up those costs or those numbers to current dollars and baked that in as an assumption that we could get that amount of money per box and then hold those prices or increase those charges at a rate that was the same as what costs were increasing. So those are some big assumptions that we baked into this model. So without getting into the weeds on all the numbers and stuff, what the model tells us is that if we just do a container facility, we need 197,000 vessel moves to get to a break-even point. The port has never, even in its heyday, done 197,000 vessel moves. But with putting in assumptions about other cargo activities and having a mixed-use terminal where those other uses contribute to some profit to subsidize the container business, as well as reducing the cost to the container business itself by making the footprint smaller and absorbing some of the administrative costs, et cetera, then we get down to 148,000 moves, which the port did when it had control of the terminal in 2008, I think was the last year that you guys hit that. But certainly a very doable number. If you go back even further, I think the next chart shows us this. So there's the volume numbers that the port's done over, 20-something years. And you can see that the 148,000 should be a very achievable number. The 198,000 will be a bigger hurdle. And let's see, it's that. So what did all this tell us at the end of the day? We have to have other uses for Terminal 6. The mixed-use model is going to help get us to a number that will be achievable. But until you hit that number, it's going to be a management challenge to not, just hemorrhage money. You have to be really careful about how you grow this business. Volume is the key to everything. Prices have to be set at sustainable levels and match expense growth, and productivity has to come in where we put it, at or above coastwise standards. Weekly Trans-Pacific service is key. I mean, Swire is great, but a once-a-month service going through Australia to go back to Asia is not going to get you where you need to be in terms of volume. This is not an easy challenge. So its success is a very high bar. As I said a minute ago, you have to align on all the things: container volumes, productivity, pricing, alternative uses. And I think the biggest thing is you need more support from regional shippers once you start to get this direct call service back. In 2014, if I go back a slide here, I think. In 2014, you were at that bottom line at 109,000 vessel moves, and that represented about 40% of the market. You need to get a lot more than 40% of the market to be able to achieve the break-even numbers. So with all those challenges ahead of you, why would you do this? And as Keith said earlier, the reason to do it is because the port's mission is to provide access to regional importers and exporters. So that's where we are to date. And I think, who's going to talk about the ILCU?
So, Madam President, I think now we were going to go ahead and step back. We can come back and answer questions. It would certainly answer questions now, but I know we have folks from the Industry Leader Committee that would like to say a few words. I think Commissioner Pierce also wanted to say a few words, kind of introducing that part.
Thanks, Keith. Before we make the shuffle, I want to thank Commissioner Pierce and the members of the committee. I know this was hard work, and thank port staff as well. Hard work with respect to a really important public asset of the port that is central to its mission, and I know it was tough, but I appreciate everybody rolling up their sleeves and providing the report and for the continued work, which I know will come from it. So thanks.
Madam President, since it may shape some of the comments of the independent leadership group by some questions now, I at least would like to ask a question or two if that works. And I think it's a tremendous job that you've done. Appreciate everybody's work on it. It's a long time project. I wonder though, as we look at this, first a comment, we've made the assumption, given our mission, that the port is important to the economic development of markets and the state, the financial condition of the state. I'm not sure we spend enough time thinking about not just how a container business itself is of importance, as opposed to the broader attributes and benefits of having a port. To your point, Oregon without a port doesn't seem like a very good circumstance for encouraging economic development in the state, new business, new jobs, everything that goes to a successful economy in the state of Oregon. So we think about the port as, or the container business, really as a part of the bigger business of the port itself. Different types of products that are brought to the state can and exported, imported, how that contributes to the larger development economically of the state, that then brings jobs. And ultimately, we need to convince the public of how important this industry is, not just the container business, but the container business as part of a bigger business for the port itself. And I think that if we don't make that transition, then the reality is we're a small port, just like I like to use the example of Pendleton. Pendleton's a small airport. It can barely survive. Well, Portland is a small marine port, and it may not be able to survive unless it connects all these different things to convince the public that it's an essential part of our economic mission. And that's a big step. So I guess my question, to the extent there's a question, and to the other members of the committee as they speak, do we have this sense of a complete package and the container being business being part of that, or are we simply making a mistake of looking only at the container business as a separate entity in and of itself, and should it survive or fail?
They're looking at me. Well, I'm happy to answer that.
I mean, we've been wrestling with this for years.
Yeah.
Well, I think in this case, the study, what it called for was to look at the container business. And as we looked at the container business, we realized that that bar was a bit high to just look at containers standing on their own. So we started looking, well, what if we had other uses? What if, you know, much to your point of looking at the container business as part of the bigger business of the port. And I think that's where we've come out, that the container business needs to exist for the regional and local economy, but it's got to be part of a bigger entity and supported by other activities that the port is involved in. So I don't know if that answers your question totally, but I'm agreeing with you, basically.
I maybe as an adjunct to Commissioner Carter's question, the consolidation and sort of realignment and rationalization within the broader industry has already impacted some other ports who have sort of found themselves on the outside of the equation. In the course of looking at those locations, was there a sort of a compelling strategy for how they reinvented themselves? I mean, has somebody who's further down this road than we are right now come to a point, have said maybe there's a disruption strategy that we can consider, or there's a way of sort of realigning these assets so that we can become viable in a way that we hadn't thought about previously because we didn't find ourselves backed against a wall? Who's come out of this? Who's made lemonade out of lemons? And who is just standing there sort of trying to figure out what the world is going to bring?
Yeah, I think some of the niche ports we looked at have made lemonade out of lemons, not because they got cut out by the consolidation and rationalization, but because they were never going to be huge ports on a standalone basis. So they found a way to survive, but they had the advantage of a population base. I still think that there's niche markets, and Keith and I and Teresa have talked about this, that Portland can look to become involved in and you know, find an anchor tenant and help that to support the kinds of volumes you need in to make the container business sustainable. So I'm not giving up on it, but I'm just saying there's a lot of things that have to come together to make it work.
Thank you.
Can you go back one slide to start with? I think it's one, maybe.
This one?
So the last statement, the reason to pursue this line of business is to fulfill the port's mission of providing access to regional importers and exporters. I'm not convinced that, I understand that's the port's mission, but our mission also is to make money and be here. And so if there are reasonable alternatives that are that fulfill that mission regionally, then I'm not sure how far out on a limb that I'm willing to go as a commissioner to make that happen, okay? And go back one more slide. Another one. It's back to the last bar graph.
Sorry.
There. When I look at that and I look at the 148,000 that was on the break-even chart a while ago,
yep.
I just wonder, you know, when you go clear back to, obviously the big shift was in 2005, can we get to 148,000? Can we maintain expenses, you know, to do that? And what's the risk if we don't? I mean, do we have another bad experience? So I guess I have some concerns, and I'll be anxious to hear. You certainly can comment about my comments, but from the other people too, about the viability of the port entering into another maybe somewhat risky business. So.
Yeah, and I guess I would just say that is our risk. That's our challenge here. We're in an operating model environment now that is a lot like what we had in place when we were losing, you know, the numbers. We were losing money, frankly, hand over fist, year over year. And we were in a business that was very difficult to extract ourselves from. We cannot be there again. And so one of the things I like about the financial model in particular, and we have, you know, this is, I won't be able to say much about this, but we are engaging in very interesting conversations about carrier service coming to Portland. We have to be very, very careful about our pricing. What happened to us in those years prior when we were losing so much money is we just simply did not price the terminal commensurate with the costs. And we can't do that again, and that's within our, frankly, that's within our control.
Keith. Just a follow-up. Linda almost made me forget it. I also don't know how. So prior to 2004, if you were doing a lot of volume but you were losing money, that's great experience, but that's not what we're supposed to be doing. And then it seems to me it's very difficult to overcome the four-day circle issue, that where it takes 4 days more out of the trip. That, to me, seems like that's just a big problem.
That's absolutely correct on a liner service, but somebody like Swire, somebody like some of these independents that I mentioned that don't have a rotation like the liner services do, can certainly work Portland in if they choose to. And I think might find it attractive to do so.
Go ahead, Linda.
Yeah, and I would just like to say the comments are all really good, and you can see how complex and how big this challenge is. And I think the beauty that came out of this is we have facts, we have figures, we have metrics, we know which way we're going. If we'll have decision points along the way. You know, maybe some of the other mixed-use areas will be bigger than we've estimated, and we'll make up, but so we won't, so it might go from 148 to 120 to make it break even and profitable. So, I mean, prior to this, it just seemed like, you know, it was a losing proposition. When I became a commissioner, I think it's been over 6 years ago, there was a lot of issues at Terminal 6. And so to learn about that and follow through and get to this point feels like, it feels like a victory to get to this point, so we have data to make good decisions and we have a process. And just while I'm at it, I would just like to say this committee, the members that were on the committee were very diverse. They brought a lot of different experience from different areas, and it was really helpful to see them be so engaged and so really, we did a lot of out-of-the-box thinking that you guys really didn't get to see, you know, condos on the river. There was a lot of great ideas out there. But, no, there was just the enthusiasm and the commitment. We're asking these people to dedicate their evenings over five different meeting times over a seven-month period, do some homework. It was just a really refreshing to work with these people and learn what I learned through this whole process. And it was just a real privilege and honor to serve, you know, as the commission liaison. But we owe a huge debt of gratitude, I think, to the committee members, and very, very thankful that they brought all their ideas and expertise and energy. And I think the most encouraging thing for me is we finally got to a place where everybody's working together. We're all trying to solve this problem for Oregon, for businesses, for the port. Everyone was just working like a family, a good family should work together. And that was just the most positive experience out of this. So I'm really anxious and looking forward to hearing the comments of the members, the people that are going to speak next. Thank you.
So can I just ask, yes, actually ask one more question? That I do agree in the short term that financial neutrality is the best we can hope for. But I would ask you, in your presentation, you talk about other ports being profitable. Are they really profitable, or are they just successful in getting money from the taxpayers?
It's a combination. Actually, San Diego is marginally profitable, but more so with subsidy, obviously. Philadelphia is profitable on its own, but it's getting tremendous amounts of subsidy and being able to create better infrastructure and attract more business by doing so. So it's a combination of things.
So my follow-up to that is, I think it's important that we're fair in terms of the comparison and expectations going forward, because to me, there is some value, if you look at this in a holistic perspective, to having a container system that is part of your port operation with commodities and everything else, because it's good for business. Whether people recognize that in the general public or not is a concern that I have greatly. And that doesn't mean, to Commissioner Levy's point, it doesn't mean that it makes any sense to just run this into the ground just to make this container service survive. But it does make sense to push people to think about container service in a bigger picture, in a bigger context. And so hopefully the folks who speak will speak to that issue as well, and to be able to demonstrate what really is the business purpose of this whole setup. Thanks.
Commissioner Tsura.
May I?
Yes, please.
Thank you very much. Thank you, all of you, for your input, Mr. Carter. I do agree with all of you. Now, my question, this probably to you, Keith. If you look at that chart, and if you look at that from a very big picture perspective of having to make a decision, looking at the next 5 years, let's say we hypothetically say, let's go for mixed-use future. And to be break-even, you got to do 148. In the next 5 years, how likely would that be for you to be able to achieve that? And on a scale of 1 to 10, where would you be in the fifth year from today?
Scale of 1 to 10?
Yeah. And if then I have one question after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the 148,000 number is, I think it's unlikely that we will have that kind of volume in 5 years. I do think it's likely we will be moving in that direction. I think our challenge is going to be, and Nolan hit on this, the nature of this business, it's a volume dependent business. So you lose money to get there. And it's how do you have the quote patient capital that mm-hmm. you need mm-hmm. to be able to get there. The way I think of this, and I don't know how to break it down 1 to 10, but I think it'll be difficult for us to get there in 5 years. I do think we'll be somewhere moving in that direction during that period. But I also think we will know whether the market has kind of passed us by within the next 3 years, because we're very much out there in the market right now. And the dust settling on the consolidations and the carrier alliances and the rationalizations, that's going to happen within this period.
I'm a business person. Mm-hmm. So when you look at a given business entity, whether it's the port operation here or whatever, if you look at that entity, there's a multitude of departments, sections that comprise the entire entity. Not all of them are set out to make money. Some departments, payroll, they don't make any money. They simply, put the money out. Mm-hmm. So again, when you look at the port as an entity, there are certain sections that may not break even, may not bring in income, which is okay, given the bigger picture, holistic approach. But I just want to know what the financial picture next 5 years based upon this mixed use might be. Let's say, would you be comfortable if you were to make this assumption? Maybe we can do 125 in 5 years. At that level, what would be the loss or the money that we're looking at? That's the kind of question I want to know from a big picture perspective. Yeah,
and one of the things I really, and I don't have that number right off top of my head here, Commissioner, but one of the things I really, really like about this study is our financial modeling is allowing us to mix and match those assumptions and fairly easily answer your question. As you know, this is part of the general fund and needs to be viewed within the sustainability of the general fund as a whole, and we are challenged there as well. So it's a very important component to an even larger picture that is our general fund, and that fund supports our industrial land business, our marine business, and our Lower Willamette work.
So it sounds like more work to be done.
A lot more work to be done. But we do have the tools in place to, I think, be very adaptive as we go. And I'll just reinforce maybe Commissioner Pierce, whether it's 148,000 boxes that we need, or whether the container footprint moves to 60 acres and we have more of the, I'll say, market-based things that are generating revenue on the rest of the acreage. I'm sure that's all going to be, we need to find that balance, and it's going to be based on, where the market is. I totally personally buy into where Commissioner Carter, where your thinking was there. I think our business model is really much more of a private sector business model here in the way that we are funded. But the mandate is a much bigger mandate that we have from the state, frankly. And that's our challenge. That's our big financial challenge.
Commissioner Seward, if I can just add a little bit there on the cross subsidy, because it's come up before, and I think Keith rightly addressed, our general fund has to stand on its own 2 feet, right? We've made a very strong point that we cannot continue to lose $2 or $3 million a year in that space. What the task is for us today, and I think for the team working on T6 specifically, is within T6, cross-subsidy is a lot easier to get your head around. Bulk covering some of container, for example, in order to provide that broader, as Commissioner Carter described, sort of broader orientation. For us to be an international city and an international port, very important. What we don't have in our general fund portfolio, sadly, is a cash cow that throws off enough to cross-subsidize across the general fund. So what we've really got to figure out is, what can we do within T6 and this 400 acres and see how we make that sustainable? I think Nolan described it rightly at the beginning. There are lots of ways to do that. I think our sort of pulling on our big boy and big girl pants is for saying you can't do that on boxes alone, right? We've got, it's got to be a broader strategy, and the industry leader group really helped us see the light in, on that in some way. And I think the task here is to figure out what's that path and how soon can you get to understanding where you, whether you make it there or not? There's been sort of a Pollyanna view on, well, you can make containers work, just use other money to do it. Those days are over, right? We've got to figure out how to make the terminal successful. And I think that we really, I'm with Commissioner Pierce here. It's been a great effort. We really are in a much better position just understanding how we might do this. It doesn't make all the answers appear magically, but it does really help
other
us.
Other than general fund, but that, are there any possible other sources of support?
You know, it's been talked about a lot. I think we've shared some of those charts about other ports do receive larger relative subsidies, including just across the river in Vancouver for the size of their operation. They get slightly more than we do. Port of Seattle gets $70 million a year in tax revenue. We are not going to get that kind of public support. You know, is there a good conversation to be had there about other methods, other opportunities? Yeah, I think we definitely would be interested in having that conversation. We have not, so with this effort, we have not set out for closing some gap with subsidy. We've tried to figure out how do you make it sustainable. The problem with the subsidy, of course, is that it too can go away. And then you're, you know, unless you're on that path, you're in the same position you were before. You've temporarily survived, but we really need to figure out how to make the business work.
So I guess I have maybe not a final question, but a question on this. Is everyone alluding to the fact that the next thing we will see, or you are probably in the process of actually putting together a business plan that would actually step us through the alternative scenarios to fill the gap between 2 and 148, and then how those scenarios, gaming those scenarios and playing them out?
I didn't even notice the 2 on that chart. That's hilarious.
Actually, zero.
Well, that's just.
And that is definitely the next kind of step. And I think we have the information available to go there with that, with the conversation fairly, you know, fairly deliberately. So, for instance, in our task force conversations and things like that, we can dive deeper into what that looks like.
And will the industry leader committee, which sounds like it's been so valuable in this process, continue to be a part of that and provide a fountain of opportunity and out-of-the-box thinking and analysis and hopefully engagement, ongoing engagement of the community?
Yeah, and so we were going to kind of save it till the end. We're stealing all their thunder, but yeah, I'm remembering back. I've been at the port now for quite a long time. When we lost the Delta Gateway, the community, it was really a kind of a gut shot to the community. We lost our access to Asia and to Japan, and we organized the port, organized what is now called the International Air Service Committee. And it's a great committee that of stakeholders in the travel industry, business travel, leisure travel, who work together to make sure we are aligning ourselves around marketing strategies for international air service. It's worked fabulously. David Zelke on my team manages that whole process. We need that on the marine side, and this group is just primed to take it to that level. We really need probably more of the cargo owners, the folks that actually own the cargo, to be engaged in the conversation. We've got a good group that was already on the industry leader committee. We need more of it, and align around how we make our pitch to various carriers, and that's going to be the next step coming out of it.
And then, what is the timeline? At least rough timeline that we would be getting briefings on that. progress?
Well, you can, as commissioners, we can give you briefings just on a regular basis on your at your regular meetings. You know, we are so engaged in market conversations right now that you're, because the pace of that work is happening, it's very much in front of us. So you're going to hear it in real time, just as we've got the BN shuttle and the Swire and all of that has come on us literally in the last month.
Unless people have other framing or questions for this group, I think it's clear that we're all engaged in this work and, again, appreciate the folks on the committee who've been working on it and the staff who've been working on it for a while. So don't go too far because we might have more questions for you. But we'll open for public comment, and we have some folks signed up. So we'll just go in order of how folks are signed up. And if you could introduce yourself and give us a sense of your associations. Brenda Barnes is first, and then Bob Carroll will be second. Four together.
Yeah, they can come up together. That's great.
Mike Stanton after.
I guess it's still good morning to the commission. And I'm Brenda Barnes with George S. Bush Company. Our company has been in business here in Portland since 1888. So it was prior to containerization. Personally, I've been in the business for 30 years and have seen quite a bit of things go on. For your information, if you're not familiar with what freight forwarding is, it's you can think of it as a travel agent for freight. We help the cargo logistically get from point A to point B, as well as put together the paperwork that is required for entry into the destination country, as well as complying with all U.S. and foreign government regulations. I've stood before you in the past, maybe not you individually, but you as a commission, to emphasize the importance of the barge when we had the container service here. I'm very involved in container shipping for these clients, and I'm here now to confirm the importance of the T6 operation. We did, together with the industry leader group, meet, I thought it was six times, so I think I heard five. with the process is with the port, the consultants, and our fellow industry leaders. It was well organized, and as you heard, there were many different perspectives. So I'm just going to give you one perspective. Every one of us also had what we called skin in the game. There was a purpose that we were part of this. We've used the port or had been engaged in the port practices and T6 prior to the non-existence of container shipping. I believe that the idea of using the rail for intermodal moves from into Seattle and Tacoma is a great thing to have start this because it allows that gate to be open. That will help the container business sustain and grow. It allows for containers to be pulled empty to load and be brought back full to load that ship throughout the work week, not just a small window of time. As this goes through with Swire, it's small, yes. You will see how the labor works, yes. But in time, that will prove to other carriers that we mean business and that our customers, the shippers, the importers are here. The advantages of having this terminal in the current situation, I want to tell you, it's closer to the source. We do not have to truck or try to rail it to Seattle, Tacoma right now. There is much congestion at the terminals as well as traffic on the roads. And if any of you have been driving from here to Seattle, you've probably seen a truck or two. if you don't know about some trekking changes, the rules didn't change, but they've demanded that the trekkers use an electronic logging device. Some trekkers will tell you they've always been on spot and never fudged the numbers. Other trekkers will tell you this is really going to hurt. And we're already seeing it. Our trekking companies are having to hire additional people just to run right at the terminal back and forth. There's an extra fee involved, okay? So if you don't have that additional time, your trucks turn faster, there's less cost. There is the space. You're not seven high in containers and somebody has to go find your container in a stack to pull it out. That's an advantage. That's an advantage for importers more so than exporters. So the space for on dock is incredible. As well as that rail service, it could be used coming in from some other place to load our ships. It's not just north and south. It could be expanded. And from my perspective, the depth of bureaucracy isn't as huge. When you start talking to terminals, and I've probably talked myself silly with some of these terminals in the Puget Sound, there's no rational person you can talk to. You used to be able to actually call terminals and talk to somebody and try to get business done. You will have an advantage 10 times over what's out there. And I'm not just talking Puget Sound. As I said, we're an international freight forwarder. We're dealing with every port in the U.S. We're dealing with every country. We're not dealing with just Pacific Rim. So when you talk niche, there may be some, you're looking at Swire going to Australia. There's cargo going to Australia. There's cargo going to South America. There's cargo going to Africa. I'm not saying that's where you're going to go. But it's there. And I think you can hear my passion. I was born, raised in Oregon, third generation. I put in my little paper. My great aunt was the first woman in Oregon to tag a buck, and I'm proud of that. I want business to stay here. If you have questions, if I missed some of those questions that you had, I'd love to answer those questions. There's many commodities that you may not even think about that used to move through this port and could move through this port again. The market's changed in those few years that we haven't been a port. You look at e-commerce. You guys probably all have bought something on the internet. How did it get here? Did it get here by plane? Or was it consolidated in a container that's being used and Amazon is bringing in that actually came through Seattle that they're dispersing now and is coming to your home? So think about those things. The market is there, I guarantee you.
Thank you, Ms. Barnes. Any questions? Mr. Carroll?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Commissioners, Robin, I'm Bob Carroll. I'm a business representative with the IBEW, International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, and I'm president of the Marine Terminals DCTU, the District Council of Trade Unions. So that's kind of the perspective that I looked at this committee with. Thanks for allowing me to speak today. But being a part of this committee has been a privilege and educational, just like Brenda was saying. I mean, I learned a lot of stuff. Nolan, the presentations he did were incredible. I had no idea some of the dynamics, and so it was a learning experience for me. And the ideas that came out of this committee, you know, some of them were a little far-fetched, and I threw a couple of those out there. But, you know, there were so many ideas, there was so much input from everybody, from the committee, from the port staff. It was incredible. I've been associated with Marine Terminals for 11 years now as a representative from the IBEW and working with the DCTU trades. And I've seen the fluctuations, the turmoil, you know, the business upheaval, the labor strife. And our members have declined. I mean, our member numbers have declined because of this, because of the work going away. You know, it's like you saw on the graph, things have just been steadily going downhill for years. And so we've lost members, especially the IBEW. You know, my hope with the work that's being done here at this committee and what the port is doing is that will change. Because it's vital that this, that Terminal 6, for a number of reasons, is successful. You know, there's so many reasons, so there's so many issues that have to be overcome or have to be dealt with to make this Terminal 6 successful. The fact that the port drew together this committee, the diversity of this committee is encouraging, and like I said, I learned a lot. I mean, because of the diversity, made some good connections, and you know, I had fun too. So, you know, I think all of us on the committee and the port staff and you as the commissioner and everything, I think you understand that now is the time to make strides. We got to strike while the iron's hot, got to do something now. I think, you know, it's something has to be done. I think that the staff and the port is on the right path. I think it's going to have to be a mixed use terminal more so than it is now. But there's challenges with all of it. I think those can be overcome though. Even during the time that Terminal 6 has been shut down, the port has committed resources to make sure that when the gate became open again, that everything was ready to go. I mean, our members worked hard on the cranes to get them up, make sure they were up to snuff. We did retrofits on two of them, that there was money gotten from the federal government and the state, I believe, to do these changes. And then just numerous other maintenance activities to make sure that everything was ready. As I said before, it's vital that Terminal 6 is successful because that success will benefit the wider community. You know, it'll help business, it'll help labor, and you know, and closest to my heart, it's going to help the DCTU and the IBEW. So I want to thank the port staff. I want to thank the other committee members. I want to thank Commissioner Pierce for herding the cats. It was a great experience for me, so thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you both again for your service on the committee. It's important to us to get the community's involvement and participation, and we thank you for that. Anyone have questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We have Mike Stanton and Greg Zanovich. We're signed up.
Good morning. First, I'd like to say congratulations.
Thank you.
Previously.
There we go. That's a little better. I can hear myself. My name is Mike Stanton. I'm the current president of the ILW Local 8 here in Portland. I'm also a full-time mechanic at Terminal 6. I work on the cranes, the container moving equipment, the trucks, the yard trucks, and just about everything else out there. There's a group that the port's kept on staff there, which is expanding. It's a good thing, and the equipment's looking good. We've got it ready. It's working well. What I got, since I had to have my comments ready, I've got a short statement I'd like to make, and I know that I'd rather be unscripted, but I'm going to go ahead and read through this quick, and I have a couple comments to add on stuff that we've hit on already with the different commissioners. So first of all, I'd like to say that I felt privileged to be included in the Terminal 6 Industry Leader Committee. The executive director and his exceptional staff put together a committee of people that were a very good representation of the groups or companies that would possibly be affected by the reopening or non-reopening of Terminal 6. The group was facilitated well and hopefully had some effect on the path the port has decided to follow to continue its mission to enhance the region's economy by providing efficient cargo access. The men and the women of the ILWU have been loading and unloading cargo on Portland docks since 1934. We've seen many changes over the decades. We see the relationship with Swire Shipping as a very positive step for our state and region. Longshore workers have been hard at work at the Port of Portland's other terminals, handling cars, bulk cargo, grain, and other goods. We are happy to be adding containers and break bulk cargo at Terminal 6 to the work we've been doing, and are looking forward to working with the other labor groups, the port, the terminal, and the terminal customers to ensure that Terminal 6 is given every opportunity to excel and grow into a busy terminal that is an asset to the local region and port. Over the last 2 weeks, container cargo has started to flow into the terminal to support the rail transload operation and staging of cargo for the first Swire vessel call coming soon. Harbor Industrial, the port management, and the ILW locals have worked very hard to put the right people in the right positions to make the terminal opening a success. I hope that the Port Commission recognizes the efforts that the Terminal 6 Industry Leader Committee, the port staff, and the individuals at the terminal have put into their reopening of the terminal. And I hope the Commission continues to support programs and ideas that will ensure that the Port's Marine Division continues to create jobs and growth for the region. And with that, yeah, Nolan was a wealth of information, overwhelming sometimes. And there's different pieces to, you know, the risk-reward graph that we had up here. There's two parts to that, that control at the bottom. And by the port maintaining some control, the risk is higher, but the reward's higher. When the port gave away a huge portion of control for the terminal, as they stated, there's terminals that haven't survived that. So there are rewards to it too, and hopefully we're looking at those down the road. And as Commissioner Carter stated, when you look at the big picture outside, when things slowed down at Terminal 6 originally, I have family members that worked at Les Schwab, which has a warehouse here, or Kroger. And it hurt. You know, I went to Costco one day and was picking up an appliance, and they didn't have the one I wanted. So I'm loading a separate one. I upgraded, but I got it out there, and I'm having the guy help me load it onto the truck. And he says, I said they didn't have the one I wanted. And he says, well, that's because Terminal 6 is closed. And so at Costco, you know, I don't know where their warehouse base is out of or where their containers come through, but it does. It affects all of us. It affects our families throughout the whole region. So one more point I'd like to make. As those shipping lines condense and as they grow, the ships get bigger. There's been certain terminals that have found out that doesn't work for them. Portland's not the biggest airport, but it's the best a lot of years. And with our terminal being small, with the container terminal being small, there's still a lot of options that we can follow to make it the best out there. And I think that's where the port's been aiming, and that's what they're directed at. There's a lot of pieces that go with those larger ships. Those container terminals that are going to bring in those big ships, if you're going to have 8 to 12 container cranes working on one ship, and 50 trucks or 60 trucks, and all the equipment that goes along with it, it creates a whole nother layer of problems that they have to deal with that maybe Portland doesn't. So for those niche market ships that we can attract, I think it's a good thing. So anyway, thank you for your time. Any questions for me?
Thank you, Mr. Stanton.
All right, thanks.
Okay, am I on? Okay. Not used to microphones. Commission, Madam President, thank you very much for letting me have the chance to talk. And I really appreciate the opportunity to have been invited by the port to sit on the committee. It was a really wonderful, experience with multiple meetings, very well organized, a lot of direction, a lot of thought put into it, with a lot of research, a lot of background. I think Keith and Teresa and Nolan really put together a good group and a good end product as well. I think I forgot to mention my name. My name is Greg Zanovich. I'm with Tidewater Barge Lines. I feel like I've been having the conversation about T6 and what to do about T6 for 20 years, because that's how long I've been involved with the terminal. I've been at Tidewater for 15 years. Prior to that, I spent 5 years working for two different carriers who, both of them actually had ships calling the terminal. I've had, and Tidewater has a vested interest in the past with what's happened at T6 and also going forward with hoping things will come back around again. You know, we used to do, you know, over 200 containers a week out of Lewiston, Idaho, mainly, you know, peas and lentils, paper products. We do up to 100 containers a week out of Boardman, a lot of hay, onions, potato products, and also up to 100 containers a week out of Pasco. So we've seen a lot of changes go on. And change is going to continue. You know, I keep hearing, you know, in polite conversations, you know, T6 just need to get more ships back. Well, you know, with the changes that have happened that Nolan and the group have talked about, those ships that we like to reminisce about, those ships are not coming back. You know, the first ship that I was involved with personally that called at T6 was 1,000 TEUs. That was the size. Total capacity, 1,000 TEUs. You know, we're hoping to attract 5,500, 6,000 TEU ships. And like Nolan and the group were talking about, they're building 18,000 TEU ships now. You know, those ships are not coming. The shippers that were using T6 or that were using our barge services going into T6, well, they've made changes too. You know, they just haven't given up. They've adapted. They found other ways to get to port. Unfortunately, those ports are, you know, further to the north. And they will come back, but it's not going to flip a switch and all of a sudden all that business is going to come back to T6. It's going to be a multi-step process because businesses don't put all their eggs in one basket. They like to have options. And it's going to take a lot of time and a lot of proof in order to even get what you once had back on in. So just like businesses have had to adapt, the terminal is going to have to adapt as well. And by adapting, you know, I really support the recommendation that the committee and the port group has put together. You need to adapt. You need to diversify. You know, using the financial catchphrase, you need a diversified portfolio, and I think that really does apply to Terminal 6. You know, it had everything with containers before. There's a lot of other opportunities out there. I know when I run into people that are not in the industry and their exposure to the port, specifically the Port of Portland on the maritime side, is all focused with what they read about in the press with Terminal 6, and they think all containers. Well, they're completely oblivious, generally, that, you know, there's 1,200 to 1,400 vessel calls on the Columbia River each year. T6, even back in the heyday 15 years ago, probably only accounted for 200 calls a year. So there's a lot of other cargo out there. You know, the Columbia River District is the largest single export port as a district of wheat in the United States, you know, for example. You know, the majority of U.S.-grown wheat that goes for export comes right out of here and our next-door neighbors on down the river. So there's other things that can be explored. And I think that the group has done a great job looking into how to go about doing that, and they're well-positioned to move forward with that. So anyways, thank you for hearing me out, and thank you for having the chance to be on this committee. If there's any questions, happy to take them.
Thank you for serving on the committee. We appreciate your time, and thank you for coming out and testifying before us. Question or comment on this matter for Keith and his team? If not, we will move on to our next general discussion item. So, Vince.
Good morning. Thank you. We're here with our annual review of the Port Transportation Improvement Plan, also known as the PTIP, which is our 20-year look at our transportation needs and our projects. Each year, we ask the Commission to hold a public hearing for PTIP, and then later we'll ask you to adopt the plan at next month's meeting. This process is necessary for us to meet our regulatory prerequisites for seeking federal grant funding for these projects that are identified in the PTIP. Obviously, transportation is important. This is what we do. We've just heard a lot of that in relationship to Terminal 6, but there are other transportation needs that we have here that the port is involved in. So for us, we review our transportation needs with you annually. We get feedback and any direction on the projects that we're looking at, and from the public as well. Phil Healy, he's our senior transportation planner. He's going to provide an overview of our plan and the projects and hear for some comments if you've got any on that. And then a public hearing will take place after that.
Thank you, Vince. As Vince mentioned, this is our annual update of the Port Transportation Improvement Plan, also known as PTIP. It helps guide our direction in transportation investment and grant acquisition. The reason we hold a public hearing for PTIP is that it meets the federal public notice requirements that qualify port projects for federal grant funding. We've provided the draft PTIP on our public website. We provided notice of this hearing in late November to the public. And outside the pro forma requirements, we've coordinated with our regional agency partners at the cities, the counties, ODOT, TriMet, and Metro for their input into the plan. The PTIP is a compilation of projects anticipated to be needed to ensure good access to port facilities and properties within and beyond the region. It is comprised of projects that are from facility plans, transportation studies, the port capital plan, and improvements needed or required in conjunction with property development. This year's PTIP includes 79 projects, not only marine and aviation capital projects, but also surface transportation projects such as road projects and rail projects. We use the PTIP to coordinate internally and also as input into the regional transportation plan. And I want to note that this year there's a major update of the regional transportation plan that the port is participating in. And one change from previous updates is that it includes equity measures. These are measures that evaluate transportation projects with regard to impacts and benefits on disadvantaged communities. The measures will include access to jobs, access to community places, safety, and environmental impacts to affected communities. And some of the ways to meet the equity measures are through improved transit and better access to job locations. And these are things that the port has advocated for with some success. For example, 24-hour bus access to PDX and improved pedestrian and bicycle connections to the airport, as well as this year we're beginning transit service to Troutdale Reynolds Industrial Park. So moving on, this is a roll-up summary of our five-year funding needs. And these areas provide focus for our overall grant acquisition and transportation advocacy strategy. And here are some of the projects that are in this year's PTIPs across the multiple business lines. So at PDX, we have PDX Next and intersection improvement at 82nd and Airport Way. At the General Aviation Airport, we have runway reconstruction projects. And at Terminal 4, we have rail capacity improvements. At Gresham Vista Business Park, we're looking at intersection improvements that are needed and would be helpful to serve that industrial park. We have underway the North Rivergate Boulevard Overcrossing Project that serves Terminal 5, and we have ongoing navigation needs. So our next steps will be to hold the public hearing, and after that, the public comment period will actually be open until the end of the week. Following that, we will finalize the PTIP and bring it back to commission in February for approval. And then once it's approved, we'll use it to submit projects to the regional governments and ODOT into their funding processes, and then we'll pursue grant funding for the priority projects as opportunities emerge. And that concludes the overview of this year's PTIP. So thank you.
Any questions from the commission?
Just one. That's not the first time.
The bus 24-hour bus service, is that a new service to the airport? Because I know it's been a problem in the past.
Yes, it is new. It hasn't started yet. They're looking at alternative routes for that. It'll come off of 24-hour bus service from Line 20, which serves Burnside. And the one that we're preferring is a line that will serve 82nd Avenue because there's a higher residential population. So it would be better employee access. So that is going to be a new service that I believe will start either at the end of this year or beginning of next year.
Great. Thank you.
Any other?
So that's great news because that's been a big deal for the, I know, employees, concession employees, whatnot here. Do you have drawings yet on the interchange for Airport Way and 205?
We do, yeah.
That'll be great to have that done as well.
Yeah.
So in terms of time, how far away are we from something changing at that intersection?
It's a few years out. We think, within the next couple of years, we'll need to get further into project development, and that it's likely it will be needed probably by 2023. And so we'll be pursuing other funding sources as we go closer to that project.
Great. Thanks.
Any other? Thank you. Okay, we'll now open a public hearing and ask if there's anyone who wishes to comment or discuss the port's transportation improvement plan. Hearing none, we'll close the public hearing. No actions required at this time. The transportation plan will be back before the commission for action next month. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we'll call Cindy Nickel now for the next agenda item.
Good morning. For situations that aren't anticipated at the time when we adopt our budgets, which in this case is more than 6 months ago, we're required under Oregon budget law to adopt a supplemental budget by the governing body prior to incurring those expenditures. When the changes to a fund exceed 10%, a public hearing is required. For FY17-18, we have three situations that weren't anticipated at the time that we put together adopted the budget, one of which results in a fund change greater than 10% and thus requires a public hearing. Suzanne Kenny, Director of Budget, Financial Planning and Analysis, will present the proposed supplemental budget and corresponding agenda item.
Good morning. As Cindy mentioned, we have three situations that were not anticipated at the time the fiscal year 2018 budget was adopted in June. They include the new container and intermodal rail service at Terminal 6 that you've heard about this morning, settlement of Lower Willamette insurance recovery cost claims, and the implementation of the short-term commercial paper program that was approved by Commission in November of 2017, and along with that, removal of the long-term budgeted bond issues. So the PDX capital funding over the next 12 to 18 months will be met with a short-term commercial paper program. In late spring of 2019, it's anticipated that long-term bonds will be issued, at which point the outstanding commercial paper, along with the remaining capital project balances, will be funded with the long-term bond proceeds. As noted in the November commercial paper presentation, utilizing commercial paper provides financial flexibility as well as lowers overall financing costs through lower capitalized interest as it allows the long-term financing of projects to be completed closer to the placed in service date. The proposed supplemental budget changes result in one fund that exceeds the 10% of the original appropriations, as Cindy noted, and results in a public hearing that's required today. So I'll review the supplemental budget and we'll then turn it over to the Commission President to open the public hearing. And following the public hearing, I'll come back with the Commission agenda item and request Commission action. So for the general fund, the supplemental budget includes an increase in revenue and expense of $4.3 million and $3.6 million respectively for the new container and intermodal rail service at Terminal 6. It also includes an increase in resources of $8.5 million to reflect the Lower Willamette Insurance Recovery Claim Settlement proceeds, as well as $2 million in expense increase to provide for the payment of the contingent fees associated with the claims recovery. For PDX, the supplemental budget includes adjustments to the resources and requirements to provide for the implementation of the commercial paper program, and as previously noted, includes the removal of the long-term general airport revenue and the customer facility charge bonds that were budgeted in the original 2018 budget. The budget for fiscal year 18, after these adjustments, will decrease by $15,650,000 for a total budget of approximately $1.7 billion. And the supplemental budget has no impact on the port's 2018 tax levy. At this point, I'm happy to answer any questions, and I'll turn it over to President Kropokomis to open the public hearing.
Any questions on this matter? Thank you. We'll now open a public hearing and ask if anyone wishes to comment on the port's supplemental budget. Seeing no comment, we'll close the public hearing. Sorry. And we'll call for a motion. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, so this agenda item and the supplemental budget address the technical appropriation adjustments to incorporate the three situations previously reviewed. The detailed supplemental budget, explanation of changes, and the revised schedule of appropriations for fiscal year 2017-18 are attached to this agenda item as exhibits A, B, and C. And at this point, staff requests approval of the executive's director's recommendation.
Call for a motion and second on the recommendation.
Second.
Having a motion and second, any comments or questions? Hearing none, I'll call for vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Passes. And we can adjourn the meeting. Thank you, everybody, for hanging in.
Thank you.